In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Bill Gates says that capitalism cannot save us from climate change. UN plans international court for climate justice. Russia's Putin says global warming is a fraud. Antarctica gaining ice, says NASA. Is global warming over? Top French meteorologist who questioned global warming fired. And finally, NOAA, that's N-O-A-A, attempts to hide the pause in global warming. Most disgraceful cover-up since ClimateGate. Those are just some of the headlines in the last couple of weeks. And that's very encouraging because it shows the rise of skepticism when it comes to global warming. Global warming is both the excuse and the reason the political left uses to grab billions of taxpayer dollars to fund itself. As we've said many times on iSpy, every time you fund an environmental program, a Democrat gets elected. But it's much more than a financial backbone for the left. It's also the foundation for so many of their beliefs. Global warming is to the environmental movement and the political left what Judeo-Christian beliefs are to the founding of America. Judeo-Christian beliefs are what create freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of self-protection, and all the founding principles and philosophies of the American system. They stem from and have their origins in Judeo-Christian principles. Take one of the most famous Bible verses, love your neighbor as yourself. Freedom of speech. If you have the right to speak freely, your neighbor should too. Freedom of religion. If you attend a church that fits your beliefs, love your neighbor and let them choose their own church. Freedom of self-protection. If someone wants to do you harm, you have the right to protect yourself and those you love, and you show your love for your neighbor by giving them the same rights to protect themselves and their loved ones as you would give to yourself. This is why America celebrates freedom, liberty, and the rights of the individual. Likewise, global warming is the foundation of the political left, and in many ways it is directly opposed to the American way of life and our Judeo-Christian heritage. No freedom of religion. Nature is the only God and you must protect it. No freedom of speech. You may not question the science. Skeptics and alternative views will be silent. Gay marriage, anyone? And no self-protection. You must be compelled to participate, even at the expense of yourself or your livelihood. For the left, it's love your nature more than your neighbor. The reality is individuals don't matter and can and should be sacrificed for the greater good, as defined by those in charge. Your business can and should be shut down if someone else thinks that it does some sort of harm. You can and should be thrown off your land because personal rights, and especially private property, aren't allowed. Understanding the belief in global warming and what's driving it and how it's spread will help you better understand the modern-day Democrat philosophies and those of socialists. But despite three decades of global warming apostles spreading the word, gaining converts, and taking control of governments, and despite hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars spent to market and make new converts, belief in global warming has stalled. Maybe it has to do with all those global warming predictions coming out the exact opposite. Maybe it has to do with the record amounts of ice in the North and South Poles. Despite all the increased shrieking and spending to tell you that global warming is real, it's really hard to ignore the 6 feet of snow outside your door and pretend the world is getting warmer. So on today's show, we're talking with Dr. Tim Ball about global warming and how it drives politics on the left. Be listening for how elements of global warming philosophy of centralized control finds its way into leftist political ideology. I'd like to welcome now Dr. Tim Ball, who received Canada's first climatology degree. Dr. Tim, it has been a year since we talked with you. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. And of course, as always, the world is moving at a breakneck speed and so much going on. And the only way to deal with it is to step back and read the paper a week late.
It does seem that way. Well, you know, speaking of reading the papers, I'm not sure what's going on, but climate change is just all over the news lately. In the last week or so, it has been plugging up my Twitter feed, my Facebook feed, Drudge Report, Right Wing News, UK papers. It is just everywhere, but probably more than ever on the skeptical side. Is there some sort of awakening happening in the press? Why the prominence?
No, the prominence is because it's part of a political agenda. What's happening is that the Kyoto Protocol, which was supposed to introduce the idea that no one nation could deal with a global issue, and therefore you had to have a one-world government to deal with it. But the Kyoto Protocol got shot down in 2009 when they leaked the fact that the scientists were creating the science they needed for their political agenda. And, of course, like with all socialist agendas, they don't quit. They just go, they withdraw and try and probe in a different direction. Mm. After the Kyoto Protocol collapsed in 2009, they brought in, at the Durban conference, which followed it, the Green Climate Fund, which is exactly the same thing as the Kyoto. That is, that all the developed countries would put money into a fund, which would then be redistributed to the developing nations because they had suffered because these developed nations had got ahead at their expense. And so that's what's going to be the central issue in Paris. Now, coupled with that, so you've got Kyoto resurrected under a different guise, but coupled with that, of course, is the concept of all nations being equal and one world government is very central to what Obama's been doing. That's been his objective right from the start. And so the combination of it being Obama's legacy and agenda and the UN Paris Climate Conference, where they're going to introduce this thing, is why you're seeing the media absolutely swamped with really outrageous stories, most of them false, but they don't care. It's about the headline, and that's what they're doing.
Well, but what's interesting, though, is I'm seeing more and more stories about the skepticism of global warming, that you're seeing things like prominent people being fired because they dare to question global warming. You're seeing things like the NOAA story, NOAA, where they were refusing to turn over documents to the Republicans. I mean, this is it's really interesting to see that it's looking like the skeptical side is starting to gain some footholds here.
Well, that's certainly true, and that's the big difference between Kyoto in 2009 and today, because as we've talked about before, when a new paradigm comes in, and of course climate change was part of the whole environmental paradigm, there are people that grab that and see either the financial opportunity and or the political opportunity. But what happens is that as that whole thing is taken on and people are bullied into silence, gradually people start to raise questions. And what's been happening is that the leaked emails really doesn't resonate very far with the general public, but they did resonate with people that are always sort of looking at things like Clive Crook, for example, at the Atlantic Monthly, when he saw what happened with the ClimateGate emails, and he said, "I thought the investigation would be a cleansing and an outlaying of what's going on," and then he realized it was just another whitewash, The level of the willingness of people to speak out now is much greater than it was back in 2009, because then you were attacked like I was with lawsuits,
sure.
the threat to be silenced. Now people are asking more questions, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is a good thing. All right. Let's go ahead and take a break right there. Everyone stay with us. I have lots more on the philosophy of global warming and how that drives so much of the political left. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Dr. Tim Ball. He was Canada's first climatologist, and we are talking about global warming and how much of that informs the philosophy and politics of the left. Dr. Ball, you had said in the last segment, you mentioned this notion of the Green Climate Fund and how that is transferring money to developing nations. But how much of that actually goes to developing nations, or is it just a line of politicians that are all lining their own pockets?
Well, of course, that's true. That comment is true of virtually anything that any government does, right or left. Mm. And that's one of the great problems that people are having. You see it in the American elections. We've got professional politicians now that get in there simply to advance their own careers. And I remember when I was working with Peter Newman on the history of the Hudson Bay Company, and he said to me, he said, there's only two kinds of politicians. There are those that say, I've got some ideas that can help the country, and there are those that say, I've got ideas that can help myself. And he said, all that changes through time is the percentage of those. And, of course, right now we've got about 95% that are in there for themselves.
Yeah.
And that's true in virtually every country in the world. So that's what's going on, and that's why you're seeing this. And of course, they will do anything to perpetuate that. And that this is, of course, it's labeled in the U.S. as the Washington mentality, and you see it in their legislation and adding writers to their bills and all of this stuff. And it's all to promote their own careers and their own wealth.
Hmm. Well, you had mentioned also the upcoming summits. Is there two of them, or is it just the one? Because there's the one in Paris, but then isn't there one coming up in Copenhagen as well?
I'm not sure. There is a preliminary meeting in Copenhagen, but Paris is really the big
one.
I see. Okay, because here's the way they set it up. With Agenda 21 in Rio in 1992, the political side of it was set up, and they set up what they called the Conference of the Parties. So you can see the acronym COP, and the COPs were to set the political agenda and the financial agenda to keep funding all of this stuff. And then they set up the science control through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. They were supposed to produce the science that the COP could then act on. And that was why the emails were leaked in 2009, about 2 months prior to the Copenhagen COP conference, which was actually COP 15. And of course, then the Conference of the Parties people were caught, because now the world knew that the science that they were using had been corrupted.
Mm.
That was the whole point of it. And by the way, to give you an idea of how corrupt and left-wing the COPs have become, at the last COP conference, they have one every year, over half of the 6,000 people that were there were non-government organizations, that is Greenpeace,
wow,
Sierra Club, and so on. And you're going to see the same thing in Paris. They'll absolutely dominate the whole conference.
Wow. Well, speaking of that Paris summit that's coming up, one of the things that they're trying to get through there is a treaty that would create an international tribunal of climate justice. And this would give third world countries the power to haul the U.S. and I would assume any other countries into some sort of global court with enforcement powers. So do you see any real teeth in this odd attempt that where they're once again trying to empower the U.N. with these kinds of powers?
There's no teeth in the sense of, you know, it's like the United Nations with their peacekeeping forces. They're toothless.
Hmm.
And they don't work. All they do is delay things. That was the problem with George Bush, that Bush, they passed resolutions in the UN and then never acted on them. And eventually Bush got to the point where he said, well, I've got to do something. And of course, what Bush should have done was not just attack one dictator, should have attacked all of them rather than just picking the one that happened to have the oil, made himself very vulnerable. But the United Nations is the most corrupt organization in the world. All that you get with bigger government is more corruption. And I remember back in the 80s, I worked out that if they just canceled first-class airfares at the UN, they would have saved $480 million a year.
Wow.
But it creates moral pressure. You see, this is the whole point of it, that they can say, oh, well, the moral pressure to act. Like, you talk to anybody about Agenda 21. We've got Elizabeth May up here in Canada, who's a Green Party. And she's, oh, well, there's no mandatory provisions in it. But then when you look at how they're doing it through municipalities with the Green Action
Yes.
Plan and all of these things. So, it can wield enormous power through the media and through the UN. But in terms of anything actually getting done, I doubt it. In fact, one of the problems they've got right now, and I think it was Greenpeace or the Sierra Club, one of them came out and said, look, countries are not contributing to the Green Climate Fund like they're supposed to, and you better start putting your money in there, and that's part of their problem, that countries like India are playing both sides of the fence. See, India is opposing the proposing the tribunal, but they also benefit to get money from the fund because they are listed as a developing nation.
Hmm.
And so it just become an absolute morass.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, like you said, it that's typical for bigger government. So in terms of getting back to the idea of this is all over the news. Another thing that's been really prominent lately is Bill Gates is now blaming global warming on capitalism. And so what is going on with these prominent people that just attach themselves to it? Because capitalism made Bill Gates.
Well, but of course, you see, this is what happens is that you're successful and then you get a guilt about it. Look at Warren Buffett. He's the biggest single contributor to Planned Parenthood. He contributes more money than anybody else. And so all of these people, Carnegie, the Rockefeller Foundation, they all get a guilt because they're coming from a Judeo-Christian background. And, of course, the idea of profit and excessive profit is wrong. So they try to buy their redemption, if you want. Ted Turner did it. Ted Turner gave $1 billion to the United Nations. And by the way, hired Senator Timothy Wirth, who was the guy that organized the Senate hearing in 1988, at which the whole climate change issue began. And as I say, he's now working at the United Nations. So these people develop these guilt syndromes, and they think they can buy immortality blaming capitalism and literally biting the hand that feeds them. But this is what's going on, and Gates is just another example of it.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting. That's exactly where I was going to go with that because, you know, a big focus of today's show is about the underpinnings of global warming and their philosophies and whether that was some sort of penance is what he's doing now. So, all right, let's go and take a break right there. Everyone stay with us. We'll have lots more with Tim Ball. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson. Talk today about global warming and how that forms the philosophical basis of a lot of modern-day Democrats and socialists, although there's not a whole lot of difference between the two. Today we are talking with Dr. Tim Ball. He is a retired professor of climatology from the University of Manitoba there in Winnipeg, and that's over in Canada, if you're not aware of where that is. He has an extensive authorship with more than 50 articles in multiple peer-reviewed journals, as well as 3 books on the deception of climate science. And so speaking of Canada, you guys just had a major shift in your politics. You hadn't had a conservative there for the prime minister for the last, 2 election cycles. But now all of a sudden you've got a new one who supports man-made climate change. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's scary because his father, who was actually an avowed socialist and a huge fan of Mao Zedong, and in fact traveled through China in the 1930s, and we've just finished paying off some of the debts that he incurred. For example, and it's very parallel with what you did, they introduced the health plan and the Canada pension plan, and the idea was that each citizen would put in a portion and the government would match it. Under Trudeau, they stopped putting in the government portion. And, of course, that's accumulated a major part of our debt.
Wow.
And so now his son's come in. The Harper government was trying to pay down that debt. The problem was, and this is going to be a challenge for whoever takes over in the U.S., people don't like austerity. They know that you got to pay your bills and you got to balance your budget, but they say, oh, well, start with somebody else. I'm okay.
Yeah.
And this is the difficulty. And conservative governments in Alberta and in Canada under Harper, the minute they try to be conservative and austere and do what needs to be done, the public don't like it. Because as Lord Macaulay said back in 1857, once 50% of the population realized that they could live off the public purse,
that's right,
democracy is over.
Yeah, that's right. So is that what you would attribute the new prime minister to, is some movement towards austerity to deal with the crushing debt that they've incurred?
Oh, yeah. I there's no question that Harper, and it happened with Maggie Thatcher. I mean, she got the economy going, but she didn't have a good social economic policy to follow it.
Hmm.
And this is what's so important. The conservatives understand that you come in and you get the budget straightened out, but then you've got to have a follow-on plan.
Yeah.
And if you don't, they're going to boot you out of power right away. And you look around the world, that's what's happening.
Hmm. Well, one of the things that he's already said is that he's going to do away with the Keystone Pipeline. Do you think that he's going to be able to do that? I mean, what are the politics like there? That does he, as prime minister, have that ability, or does that still have to go through some sort of legislative cycle?
No, he has the power to do that. And in fact, the power of our prime minister is really frightening.
Hmm.
And we don't even get to vote for him. You see, this is the problem. And he got elected with 39% of the vote.
Wow.
Huh. So not even 40% of the people voted for him, and yet he's now our prime minister. And so that means you've got 61% who were not in favor of him. And this is the difficulty. And you've got the problem that you might like your local candidate, but not like the person that they're offering as prime minister, but you've got no choice. So what happens is that the party, so it's like you vote for the Republican and then they choose the president. And this is why the Americans got away from the parliamentary system.
Hmm.
And the power of the prime minister is really almost similar to a monarch.
Wow. You guys have had another shift up there, a very fascinating one, actually, especially for followers of iSpy, in the sense that you guys had a transfer of public lands to private landholders. And that is really one of the foundational aspects of the American system, is that we had this belief in private property. And, of course, global warming and the global warming alarmists and the people pushing this sort of thing, they are very opposed to private property. So why don't you talk to us about the effect there that had in terms of turning over some of those public lands up there?
Well, we need to go back in history a bit, actually back to 1215. that's the Magna Carta was signed, right? Yeah. Well, you see, people and all of these left-wing lawyers will tell you, oh, no, the Magna Carta, it was a great emancipation of land and so on. It wasn't. What it was a group of very powerful landowners given land by William the Conqueror, and they didn't like what the king was doing, so they got together and said, hey, this is the way you're going to function. Had nothing to do with private ownership of land. The peasants on their land were still tenants on the land.
That's right.
And it was only when America came in that free speech and the private ownership of land became the first nation in the world at which an individual citizen could do that. You see that here in Canada, because any land that's not privately owned in Canada is called Crown land. That is, it belongs to the Crown. It belongs to the government. And there's been some attempts to do a public-private partnership in Canada, and that's what this land issue was all about. But ultimately, when you look at what the deal was, it still ultimately belongs to the Crown.
Hmm.
And you see a somewhat similar argument going on in the U.S., because they challenged Donald Trump over his views on eminent domain. And that's part of this same argument that can, for the greater good, and that's what socialists always work on,
yes.
Can the government step in and squash the individual for the greater good? And so what's happening here in Canada really doesn't change anything underneath. And one of the reasons that the revolution occurred in the United States was because it was actually a revolution of the British people. Most of the people involved in the American Revolution were born in England or were recently come from there as first-generation Americans, like Franklin. And, of course, they recognized all of these issues, and they introduced all of these issues. Canada was formed out of those people that didn't want to have a Republican system. And all of Eastern Canada was settled by people fleeing from the United States called United Empire Loyalists.
Huh.
But Canada is still a monarchical system that all of the land ultimately belongs to the Crown, and the Crown can effectively take it back anytime they want.
Well, that's very interesting. All right, I'd like to pick up on that when we come back with Dr. Tim Ball. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, keeping an eye on big government. On this week's show, we're keeping an eye on global warming, which has been all over the news lately. And we especially want to look at that in terms of how that forms some of the philosophical underpinnings of much of the Democratic and Socialist parties here in the United States. And to do that, we're talking with Dr. Jim Ball. He was Canada's first climatologist, and he is now a retired professor of climatology from the University of Manitoba up there in Canada. And so speaking of Canada, we were going into the break there talking about the transfer of public lands to private individuals. But Carla Davenport, my producer, was reminding me it wasn't so much a transfer to private individuals. What it was a transfer of the control of that land from the national, so to speak, down to the provinces. And so am I getting that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And the important thing is that this is again, parallels the battle going on in the U.S. between states' rights and the federal government. And in Canada, under our constitution is called the British North America Act. And under that, the resources belong to the provinces. And so it creates a great difficulty for the federal government trying to do things. And so this is part of that battle that's going on, because it's like with water, most of the uses of water are under the federal jurisdiction. So if water crossing international or even state or provincial boundaries, then the feds are in control. But and selling water overseas is federal control. But the water itself belongs to the provinces. And if the parallel is, it's a bit like, my son says, can I have the car? And I say, yeah, you can have the car, but you can't have the keys. Right? And then my son says, but I own the gas station. I say, fine, okay, but then I'm going to have to do an environmental impact of your gas station and stop you running it for a while. So wow. These are the kinds of conflicts that are going on. So there are parallels everywhere, but they're all evolved from the original establishment and uniqueness of the United States.
Huh. Well, you know, so much of global warming and the environmental movement is all about centralized control. We certainly see that in terms of resources and whether or not you're allowed to develop some of those natural resources. In terms of the new prime minister, do you see him reversing some of these transfers from the federal to the provinces up there? Or do you think he'll go ahead and maybe keep those in place?
No. His father and he are very, very much federalists. That is, that they want more and more power for the central government. And, of course, the Canadian situation is such that they can get that, but the limitation or the lever that the provinces have is in the control of the resources. And so this is what the battle is, that's going on. But the new Trudeau will push for that. And of course, as I mentioned, back when Quebec wanted total control of its own destiny as a separate nation, and they applied under the United Nations Charter, which Woodrow Wilson said, if you can identify yourself as a nation that is a group of people with a distinct cultural identity, then you're entitled to have a state. Hmm. And so Quebec applied under that rule. And there was a thing called the FLQ, which was a terrorist group that were fighting for the freedom of Quebec.
Wow.
And Trudeau brought in the War Measures Act. And the War Measures Act allowed the federal government to cancel all rules and regulations within Canada completely. Every citizen lost every right that they had.
Wow.
And he then took the Canadian Army and suppressed what was going on in Quebec with using the Canadian Army against Canadian citizens.
Yeah, and I think that's a perfect example of what we see really stemming from this global warming and environmental philosophy, where it is all about centralized power and centralized power at all costs.
Yep. Hmm. And of course, as I said earlier in the program, they wanted a vehicle that was international, that crossed boundaries. Because, of course, you see, what's happening with the world right now is that the traditional pattern of the world, that started with the Berlin Conference in 1874, where the colonial powers divided the world up and drew boundaries around the world. And then the First World War and the Treaty of Versailles, which was probably the worst treaty ever written. And then the treaties that were written after the Second World War and the financial agreements that were done there, those are starting to be challenged and starting to fall apart. And it's all happening at the same time. But of course, what happens when things get into disarray, that's when these opportunists step in and seize the opportunity to grab control. And that's what's happening at the United Nations. One of the things that's going on at the UN has been going on for a couple of years now is that, and it's important to understand this, the UN really cannot function, not just because it doesn't have the police force or the military power, but here was their difficulty. Each nation had a vote, but that meant a nation with 60,000 people had the same vote as China with 1.5 billion people.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And that they couldn't go to a vote proportional to your population size, because then China would dominate and India would dominate, so they couldn't allow that. What happened then was those that wanted to use the United Nations, and this was particularly with the climate change issue, they would get all of those very small nations and say, look, we'll throw money your way if you support us in this United Nations vote. That's what's going on now with India and China. So they say, we're going to get all these small nations. And they're doing it under the auspices of the BRICS group, which is the Brazil, Russia, India, China, and mm-hmm. South Africa group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay? And this is why you got countries like the Maldives were suddenly so front and center. Oh, yeah, no, we're drowning. We're going to drown with sea level rise. You've got to stop this. And that's why they had so much power, with because they had one vote equal to the Americans' one vote.
Well.
And all of this is now being exploited by a different group. And the BRICS group, by the way, have already set up a financial fund to parallel the International Monetary Fund, which is handling the Green Climate Fund.
Mm.
So these are the battles that are going on a global basis.
Always learn so much whenever you're on air, and but unfortunately, a lot of what we learn just isn't very good to hear. All right, we're going to have lots more with Dr. Tim Ball talking about global warming. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpire Radio Show. Talking today to Dr. Tim Ball. He was Canada's first PhD, I should say, in climatology. He's a retired professor of climatology at the University of Manitoba, and talking a lot about the philosophical underpinnings of the environmental left. And, you know, it's interesting looking at some of these philosophical underpinnings. And as you're talking about global warming, I just see so much of that being reflected with how the Democrats view power. You can see it all with Obama. It is not about working with the other side. It is about doing it my way or not at all. And it's just kind of amazing how much of that whole sort of communist manifesto and the communist view of the world and that centralized power has just bled over into the Democrat Party. But what's interesting, though, is that I am finding myself agreeing lately with Putin on things like he says that global warming's a fraud. He is all for wiping out ISIS. He says that we're taking the wrong steps there in Syria and whatnot. So it's interesting. In some ways, Putin is almost sounding a little bit like a conservative. But in terms specifically of what he is going after there with global warming, why is he the leader of what used to be the Soviet Union? Why is he now all of a sudden coming out opposed to global warming?
The Russians and then latterly the Soviets, now again the Russians, have always been very, very focused upon weather and climate because of their conditions. And just to give you an example, I worked with the Russian and then Soviet climatologist Boris Senkov on something called the Russian Chronicles. These were started in the year 1000 with the Romanov Empire. And, of course, the Romanovs were actually Vikings, just like William the Conqueror was from Normandy. He was a Norman, he was a Viking. And Moscow was founded by the Vikings. They, what was important to them and the power was, what were the crops doing? because they knew if the crops failed, they would have social unrest, and they had to get the troops out ready to deal with that. So from 1000 AD onwards, they kept daily or monthly and yearly records of weather and crop conditions, and Borisenkov was looking at that. And the Russians, of course, realized that there are cycles to the weather. And so that's what Putin comes from, a background of very great awareness. And by the way, even in the stock market, the Russians were the first to look at stock market cycles related to food production and weather conditions. And there's something called the Kondratiev cycle, which many people working the stock market are aware of. Now, Putin was actually opposed to Kyoto, and he sent out his economic advisor, a fellow by the name of Andrei Ilarionov, and he traveled around the world with a very, very good PowerPoint presentation showing what was wrong with the science of the IPCC and the climate change issue. I went to Vancouver, watched his presentation. It was a very good presentation. Ilarionov went back to Russia, and 3 months after he got back, Putin announced, "I'm going to sign Kyoto." And Ilarionov resigned in protest. Now, why did Putin sign Kyoto? He came out and said why he was going to do it, which is what people like about him. You don't necessarily agree with him, but you know what he's thinking and where he's going. He doesn't pull any punches. It's like Trump. And he said, "I signed it because if I didn't sign it, the European nations were going to block Russia's application to the World Trade Organization." And that was more important to him economically than being part of the Kyoto Protocol. And the Kyoto Protocol had to have Russia involved because the rules were that they needed enough nations that produced 55% of the world's CO2 signing onto it for it to become a treaty or a protocol. And since the Americans refused to sign, they were the only country left that could possibly get it ratified was Russia. And so they and Putin actually said it. He said, "They blackmailed me." And of course, now he's looking at the deal in Paris and saying, "No, I can make more money by not getting involved in this thing." So he's gone back to his original position of opposing any use of the climate and global warming for a political agenda. So that's the story behind what Putin is doing.
Interesting. All right. I'd like to follow up a little bit on that, but we'll have to wait until the next segment. Everyone stay with us. Lots more with Dr. Tim Ball. Talk about global warming. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talk today about global warming and how so much of that philosophy trickles down into the, well, I should say trickles up, maybe into the Democrat and far-left policies and philosophies. And to do that, we're talking with Dr. Tim Ball, a retired climatologist out of Manitoba, Canada. And Dr. Ball, you were saying some really interesting things there about Putin and how he has now reversed his position. And he's, like I said, he has come out now saying that global warming is nothing but a fraud. Do you think that's some of what's driving some of these articles that are just really inundating the news cycles?
Oh, absolutely. Because the people that are promoting Paris and the Green Climate Fund see this as a real threat. Now, remember I mentioned earlier the BRICS group. Well, Russia's part of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So they are actually on the side that are opposing the Western world control of the United Nations. And as I said, they're not only doing it in terms of the climate issue, but they're doing it in terms of opposing the International Monetary Fund. And by the way, there's also China. They're planning to build that canal through Nicaragua to take a lot of the power away from Panama.
Yeah.
So that's all part of the same strategy. The other thing is that we're also going back to what gave the British Empire control of the world. And as you know, they said that the sun never set on the British Empire because it was right around the world. Somebody else said that the sun didn't set on the British Empire because you couldn't trust the English in the dark. But that's another story. But sea power and control of the world's oceans are really where it's ultimately at.
Wow.
And Reagan understood that. That's why he built up the Navy with the different fleets that he had. The Navy under Reagan was built to the biggest and most powerful Navy in the world. Obama's undercutting that now.
Yes,
he's got nine of the big aircraft carriers parked in Norfolk, Virginia. But this is what, if you look at who controls world container shipping, it's the Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see their I think, what, Green Line they call it, is the line. But they are taking control. China is also building nuclear submarines as fast as they can. So when you start to look at how they're taking control, you go back to the original things that gave power groups control, and control of the oceans is certainly a major part of that.
Yeah. Well, so here's an interesting dilemma. Is you've got Putin there saying that climate change is a fraud, but then you've also got, as you said earlier, that they have 1,000 years or more of climate data. So why not then release that to help to show that there is absolutely no history of global warming?
Well, a lot of it is available. One of the things that was interesting during the Cold War was all of the work that the Soviet scientists were doing was simply not available to the West. Mm. And when the Jewish people started getting out of Russia, Soviet Russia, well, after Israel was formed, enough of them got to Israel, they set up a translation service, and suddenly we had this flood of scientific information about what the Soviets were doing. And of course, they brought all of the stuff that people like Borisenkov that I worked with, that suddenly then became available on the world market. Again, the division between the East and West over the climate change issue is still there. The Chinese and the Russians believe that the climate is in cycles, and that one cycle overlaps another one. All you've got to do is sort out all the different cycles, and you end up with the net of that is the climate. The Western world opted and said, no, it's chaotic. That's where you hear this argument about, oh, a butterfly flaps its wings Japan and you get a storm. That was seen as a political division between East and West. In fact, it wasn't. It was very much a scientific division, and that division still exists. And that's the battle that's also going on with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And by the way, Yuri Israel, who was the president of the Russian Science Foundation, refused to go along with the British Royal Society that were co-opted into getting all royal societies around the world to say that the climate change was settled, that the debate was over. And you hear them saying, oh, well, all the societies agree with it. That was engineered by Lord May of the Royal Society. Yuri Israel, the leader of the Russian Federation, said, no, it's still rubbish. So this battle has been going on, but I said it just doesn't make the headlines.
No. We only got about a minute here with you. Yes. Real quick, what do you see as the future of global warming if somebody like a Ted Cruz or a Donald Trump gets into office? These are people that are very much opposed to it. What do you see happening there?
Well, I think that the only reason that it's continuing right now is because virtually every politician, even some of the Republicans, are still afraid to come out and say anything that might hint that they're not in favor of the environment. It's what I call eco-bullying.
Yeah.
Cruz and Trump and these people are prepared to say no. And of course, what will happen is that then gradually some of the mainstream media who have been the big mouthpieces for this, particularly the New York Times and the Guardian, they'll start to realize that the bigger story is in the deception that's been practiced.
Wow.
And then there'll be an absolute rush to the other side. At that point, my fear is that the use of environment and climate change for a political agenda will mean that real issues will come up, and people will say, well, you lied to us before, we're not going to listen.
Yeah.
And the cry wolf syndrome will kick in. But that all it needs is for somebody to have enough nerve to stand up and say, no, hang on a minute.
Yeah.
And then people will get in behind that, and the change will come very rapidly.
Very interesting, and that gives me a lot of hope in terms of undoing global warming and the effect that it has, the grip, I should say, that it has on our society. Dr. Tim Ball, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Before we go, I'd like you to head to iSpyRadio.com, and on today's show page, you'll see a link to a map put out by actual government scientists showing global warming caused 14 extreme weather events last year. It shows that global warming caused extreme heat and extreme cold. It caused extreme rain and caused drought, ice melt, and ice increases. Feel free to share that map with your friends or send it to your elected official. Ask them, do you honestly believe that global warming causes heat and cold, rain and drought? Because if you do, you're kind of unfit for office. We're at a tipping point in this whole global warming debate. And whatever you do, don't be silent. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.